Hello, and welcome to the Biotech 2050 podcast. Biotech 2050 is a think tank chronicling the disruptions changing the biotech industry over the next several decades. Check out our website at biotech2050.com or on your favorite podcast listening platform. I'm Rahul Chaturvedi, co-founder of this podcast and today's host. I'm also the founder and CEO of Clora. Clora is a platform that enables biotechs to build agile teams while accessing the best talent. Check us out at clora.com. Very excited to welcome Ray Stevens, founder and CEO at Structure Therapeutics. Thanks for joining us today, Ray.
Thank you, Rahul. And it's an honor being here. Really been looking forward to this.
Wonderful. We really appreciate your time. Ray, to kick us off, would love if you could talk to us about the arc of your career, how you got interested in biotech, and then what got you to where you are today.
Absolutely. So I'm not going to go all the way back to the beginning, but I will start with, I come from the great state of Maine, and I'm very proud of that. It's been a long journey. When I was finishing undergrad, I was deciding between getting a PhD in chemistry or going to business school. I enjoyed both parts. When I was an undergrad, I used to do homework with my friends who were business majors. For fun, I would do that. But then once I calculated that going to business school, I was going to be in debt versus going to get a PhD in chemistry, they would actually pay me. I picked the chemistry PhD route. So I did my PhD at University of Southern California. After that, did a postdoc at Harvard University with Bill Lipscomb, and then started my independent academic career as an assistant professor at UC Berkeley in the chemistry department. And then from there, one of my first students that I had, Nathaniel David, joined my group, and he joined because he wanted a biotech company. And if we had a breakthrough in the science, then we agreed that we would get a company started out of that. That company we did, in fact, get started. It was a company called Syrex, one of the first high-throughput structure-based drug discovery companies. After Berkeley, moved on to Scripps Research in La Jolla, started another biotech company called Memorex, then started another company called Rei, then started another company with students, Mike Hansen, and some others called Receptos. We ultimately, I think, went public in 2013, and then that company got acquired in 2015, if I remember right, by Celgene, which then became BMS. And that drug that we developed there is now in the market called Zeposia, an S1P1 agonist. During that time, I have three kids, and I felt like my kids were becoming a little spoiled on the beaches of La Jolla, California. And so decided to do a sabbatical. One of the nice things about being in academia is every 7 or so years, you can go off and do a sabbatical. So gathered up the kids. We were supposed to go to Japan. This would have been 2011, bouncing around a little bit here. And I'm not sure if everybody remembers, but in April 2011, the tsunami hit Japan. So with three little kids, I think our kids were about 6, 8, and 10 at the time, decided we could not do a sabbatical in Japan. We weren't sure about radiation, power, and stuff. So somewhat by accident, we ended up moving to Shanghai, China for the one-year sabbatical. That one-year sabbatical, like often happens, we were nervous about going there, but we absolutely fell in love with the Shanghai community, particularly the expat community. And from there, that sort of led to really traveling around the world with the family, with our kids. And my wife really starting to see more part of the world. And it's also the age of the kids. And we came to appreciate this really big difference, inequality in access to medicine, that we have all these great breakthrough medicines that are out there, antibody drugs, peptide drugs. But the fact is they're only available to about 1/3 of the world. 2/3 of the world doesn't get access to these medicines. And so that's really what sort of formed the genesis for starting this next company that I'm currently CEO of. But that's the history of serial entrepreneur, always started companies with my previous students, getting them going to where I am today.
So Ray, you mentioned you've been a serial entrepreneur. Take us back to what you were like as an entrepreneur the first time you did it versus now how you approach entrepreneurship and just the evolution of your own approach to leading a team.
Yeah, absolutely. So the very first company that I got started was a company called Syrex. And again, this was with one of my former students, Nathaniel David. And we had no idea what we were doing. First thing we did was we went over to one of my chemistry department colleagues, Peter Schultz, who had started a couple of biotech companies. And we asked Pete for help, asked him for advice. I cannot say enough things about the importance of a mentor. Pete was, one, he was generous with his time. He introduced us to VCs, venture capitalist, that helped us with our story. And we could not have gotten that first company. First, we could not have gotten the company started without Ned really taking the initiative and being the driving force. Second, having Pete Schultz as a mentor on this first company was critical. And having somebody that can help us And then three, teamwork. I remember taking calls at 2 a.m. because nothing was working in the lab and we were worried about this and what are we going to do? We had maxed out our own credit cards to the highs of we just closed the Series A financing and this is the best thing in the world. As I was listening to one of your other podcasts, they were talking about the highs and lows of biotech building. And they're certainly there. Certainly experienced that back then and continue sort of over the years. Fast forwarding, I've been doing this now for 25 years. What I've learned, this recent company that I started called Structure Therapeutics, we did not take any venture capitalist financing until we really had the company well in shape, organized. We had the team formed. And so I think I've taken a more, with the knowledge that I have, it's taken a more strategic approach. The one thing that you can't control at all is the markets are always changing. And so one of the things, again, I don't know whether this has been luck, but it's just what's happened. Receptos, the company that I started more than 10 years ago, we took Receptos public in 2013. And I'm not sure if you remember, but that was the bottom of the market. There was a horrible time to do an IPO, but really strong companies do well in those type of markets. And I think it was the past experience that helped us with strong support from our investor base. To now, we took Structure Therapeutics IPO last February. We're just about on our 1-year anniversary right now. Similar, bottom of the market, strong companies do well in these type of markets. And so that really helped. But I'd say over the years, it's been gaining more and more experience and learnings and trying to constantly apply them, but also recognizing times are always different and you have to adjust. Every company is different.
Yeah, certainly that resonates. I'm curious, as you think about your own journey and you're involved in a handful of things, you're a professor, I believe you sit on some boards as well. How do you structure your own time on a daily or weekly basis to make sure that you're doing what the company needs, but also managing, as you mentioned, the ups and downs of being a CEO?
By nature, I'm just a very organized person. Ever since I was a little kid, everything had its place on the desk. And it drives my family crazy that I can notice if somebody moves my stapler. It's a little silly, I know, but it's who I am. So being organized is really important. And it's also important for consistency. I think what companies getting through is tough times, you need to have stability, consistency. So I think a lot about that. As a CEO, even as a founder, I think by nature, we're optimistic. My wife says that I have selective memory. I only remember the good and I don't remember all the bruises and all the pain over the years, all the hard work. And so I think that also certainly helps with the optimism. But then going through the journey of life, I don't want to go through it with a sort of negative attitude. I want to think about all the sort of positive things and what we can do to make this planet a better place. So that's what sort of drives me. And that goes into my favorite interview question when I interview people for the company is I ask them, are you a lucky person? And it's fascinating, the answers that I get. Most of the time people say, yeah, but then I'll ask them, why are you lucky? What happens? And it'll be interesting to listen to the stories that they tell. Sometimes they'll say, I remember it was a student and he said, no, I'm not a lucky person. I said, why? He said, my past advisor won't publish my papers because he doesn't really believe my data. And my girlfriend just left me and I don't have a place. And I was feeling so bad for this guy. But do I want to work with somebody like that? It's probably sad to say, but no, I want to be surrounded by people that have the same passion for life, same positive attitude, because when you go through the tough times, the team needs to have a positive attitude. And that includes coming from me as the CEO.
Yeah. I love that question. I imagine it's a way to understand if someone is obviously optimistic or pessimistic and how they'll be through those tough times. Yeah, I really like that.
If you're an HR or hiring manager in biotech, you know all too well that the pool of experts seeking full-time employment is shrinking. Filling key full-time positions can be a long, drawn-out ordeal that can slow the pace of execution and growth. Throw away the old hiring playbook. Now you can build a biotech dream team in a fraction of that time. Find out how. Visit clora.com. Clora, talent optimized.
Okay, so switching gears now, Ray, you mentioned the field of structure biology, and we talked a little bit about structure-based drug discovery in the past as well. I'd love to hear from your perspective what structure-based drug discovery is, and prior to that approach, How was drug discovery being approached and what were the challenges with that approach?
So when I was a postdoc at Harvard, this would have been late 1980s, there were two companies, Vertex in Boston and Agron in San Diego. I really credit those two companies with being the pioneers for the field. I'm personally a very visual person. I got into, as a graduate student, structural chemistry, structural biology, where I could visualize and see the molecules. I get a lot of pleasure out of actually seeing the atoms, where they're located. And so structure-based drug discovery, Vertex and Agron really demonstrated for the first time that you could use these three-dimensional structures of proteins and design molecules that go into the binding site. Before that, we would use high-throughput screening, which I consider, they become very powerful tools, but you're not really looking, you're just putting things together and seeing what sticks. Structure-based drug discovery, you look at it, you figure out there's an electrostatic pocket there you can really take advantage of, or there's a hydrophobic pocket you could lay down some ring groups on. And so I think going back to the late 80s, early 90s was when the field was started. By visualizing this, it really helps, I think, the quality of the drug candidates come out better. But one of the caveats, you know, you could get a PhD in determining a three-dimensional structure of a protein. It was about 3 to 5 years to get a single structure. That's a long time. And in drug discovery, one doesn't want to wait that long. I think what's really transformed in the field since the late 80s, early 90s, is we can now get structures. You know, the company that I started called Cyrex was one of the first high-throughput structure-based drug discovery companies. We were getting structures within a few hours to, if not a few days. Those were with cold crystals soaking in and then quickly collecting the data. And now today, about 6 or 7 years ago, a big breakthrough in the field of structural biology took place with the introduction of cryo-electron microscopy for biological samples. And I give a company, FEI, a lot of credit. They created the first microscopes optimized for life science, not for physics or material science. That's changed it. So whereas now, high probability of success, really quick turnaround times, we can get this structural and dynamic data as well, almost in real time. And so the field of structure-based drug discovery has only gotten more and more powerful today than it was 20 years ago.
And Ray, talk to us a little bit about how you're applying that at Structure Therapeutics and how it served as a bit of a force multiplier for you.
Yeah, so I'll take a sort of step back just for a second to help set the stage for it. So when I was starting my academic career at UC Berkeley, I took a portfolio approach, comes back to the business perspective. And I had a low-risk project, a medium-risk project, and a high-risk project. My low-risk project were working on enzymes. Relatively robust, you could get these structures and design inhibitors. Medium risk, I worked on a protein called botulinum neurotoxin that was being developed for different neuromuscular diseases. And then my high-risk project, the holy grail, what I really wanted was trying to get the structural information on G protein-coupled receptors. You have 826 of these receptors in your body. You see me because of rhodopsin. You smell because of olfactory receptors. My heart's beating because of adrenaline, the adrenergic receptors. And membrane proteins were considered to be extremely difficult. And we failed. We worked on this for 15, going on 18 years, failed miserably. NIH would not give us grants, failure after failure. But I knew that if we could get a breakthrough where we could get the structural information on this family of proteins, it would open up doors everywhere, both for structure-based drug discovery, but for basic science. And so the NIH created a program called the Roadmap Initiative, started by Elias Zerhouni, director of the NIH, which went after really high-risk, really difficult projects. One was membrane proteins. We got a grant for this, finally. And this is what helped to enable the technology that then led us to finally getting, in 2007, after about 20 years, finally getting the structure of the beta-2 adrenergic receptor. And that's what led to the founding of Receptos. Receptos got acquired, so the company ended it. And that's what led to the foundation of Structure Therapeutics, where we realized with getting the structural information on G protein-coupled receptors, we could finally do structure-based drug discovery on this membrane protein family.
Yeah, thanks for setting the stage there, Ray. So talk to us a little bit now about where Structure is from a development perspective, how large the team is, and any upcoming inflection points that you can share.
Yeah, absolutely. So we got Structure Therapeutics started in around 2017. Again, we didn't take any venture capital at the beginning. We paid the way out of our own pockets directly to get the company started. And we chose, in terms of targets, We knew the technology platform was robust, but we really wanted to have some initial molecules that could really help us in intellectual property. So we teamed up with Schrodinger out of New York. I know Rich Friesner from Columbia, the founder of Schrodinger. Rich wanted to work with us because we were one of the best labs in the world at G-protein coupled receptors, getting the structures. We wanted to work with Schrodinger and Rich because I think that they're one of the best companies at computational chemistry, physics-based methods in computational chemistry. So we worked together, sweat equity, for a couple of years, and we had three programs. The GLP-1 receptor we viewed as, again, one of the holy grails, if we could convert a peptide drug into an oral small molecule. Second program was the apelin receptor. That was in pulmonary disease. Again, there were peptide drugs out there. We wanted to make an oral small molecule. That became our starting point. We, working with Schrodinger, developed intellectual property around small molecules. And that's really what got the company going to where we could then go to and get venture capital for the company. So that was the sort of the ground roots of how we got started. Now, where are we today? Fast forward 4 years later, after taking our Series A venture capital, we did our IPO 1 year ago last week. So that was the big milestone. Our GLP-1 program is now in phase two clinical studies. Our apelin program is now also phase two ready as well. And part of the reason we were able to go public, one, we had a good, strong management team. Second, really good investors. Our initial investors that we had in our Series A, you know, it was F Prime there in Boston, Sequoia, Qiming. These are just great investors to have. And then our Series B, we brought in TCGX, BVF, many, again, really strong investors. And then couple that with being in the GLP-1 space. We started working on GLP-1, again, for me, 20 years ago. It's become very fashionable now, but we also are in an area that's really hot in terms of weight loss that's being observed and treatment of diabetes and this obesity epidemic that's currently ongoing. So that also helped us lead us to having a successful IPO last February.
That's great, Ray. I'm sure you could have raised venture capital when you founded Structure, just given your track record. Talk to us about why you decided not to take on external capital. And for those that are thinking about raising VC right now, what changes in terms of how you approach company building when you take on external capital versus you're able to fund it yourself?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a really important question. So first, we were fortunate. We had some money in our pocket so we could use to incorporate the company and pay some of the legal bills initially. But I think one of the big lessons that I learned, particularly with Syrex and with Receptos, was we had pressure on day one to do strategic partnerships with companies. And that was to help sort of complement the venture capital financing that we brought in. When we started Structure, we didn't want that pressure of having to do a partnership, because what my experience was, we worked really hard to satisfy those partnerships because we didn't want any negativity coming from, what if it doesn't work? When we started Structure, we asked our investors, we said, look, we don't want any pressure to do a strategic partnership. We already have intellectual property that's been generated from doing this. We have a platform. We've generated IP. We really want to take your investor dollars and focus them on the assets that we currently have, not on finding a partnership and subsidizing that partnership. So we chose investors that agreed with this attitude. And that was absolutely critical, particularly Robert Weisskopf, I remember from F Prime. It really resonated with him that this makes sense. We did not feel we had to validate our platform. We didn't feel we wanted the additional pressure. We really just wanted to advance our assets because we saw that as the real value driver, the big value inflection point. So that was the mindset as to not doing any partnerships, focusing on creating our own drug molecules and advancing those.
Sounds like your own mental model has evolved quite a bit as it relates to partnerships for early stage biotech. So talk to us about when is the right time to partner for early stage biotechs. We're recording this in Q1 of 2024. There's been a lot of partnerships going on, but would love to hear your perspective on the right time.
Every company's different. You know, if you have a new technology with a lot of like these AI companies that we see, they want to explore, they want to get a larger data set of experiences. I think it makes sense to do a partnership early on. It's beneficial to the partner, it's beneficial to the biotech company. And you can explore the space efficiently. It's also capital, I think, efficient that way as well. For us, we really view the value as our company is not in our platform. The value of our company is in our assets that we have. So we wanted to make sure the investor dollars were going to the right place, which was to advance those assets as much as possible. Now, that being said, we're not completely naive. We're in a space, particularly GLP-1 space, where it's in diabetes and obesity. These are large chronic diseases. Our phase 3 trials will be extremely costly. And so we recognize we will not be able to commercialize this ourselves. From that perspective, then if you back calculate from we're going to need a partner to commercialize, that means a partner is going to almost certainly want to be involved in the phase 3 that leads into commercialization. So we look at this as we will partner the phase 3 in commercialization, which is much earlier than young, small biotechs. They might partner earlier on. Every company's different. You got to think about it that way. And when is the right time to have a partner? And what's the best value creation inflection points along the way?
On the topic of value creation, before we started recording, we were talking a bit about distributed teams and the pros and cons and how it helps accelerate value creation. Talk to us about the structure of the team at Structure and the advantages that you see with the distributed team approach.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, this comes from past experience, past companies. I've been very fortunate. All the companies that have started before have all been acquired, and some for Receptos, a little over $7 billion US dollars. It was a great exit for shareholders, and it got the drug to market as fast as possible. But it's also painful when your company gets acquired and they take the one asset. In that case, Receptos, it was an S1P1 agonist. It was everything else just got flushed down the drain. So when we set up Structure, we decided we would do things a little bit different. Structure technically is a global company. We're Cayman Incorporated. We hold all of our intellectual property in Delaware C corporations. So each one of our programs is in a different Delaware C corporation. So our GLP-1 program is in a C corporation called Gashobrum. Our Apelin program is in a Delaware C corporation called Annapurna. These are all named after mountains that I like climbing. And so we did that. It would open up opportunities or optionality for partnering so that if we partner one program, then we wouldn't have to dissolve the rest of the company. So that was one thing that was important to us. The other piece is building the team. Being a global company, we didn't want to restrict ourselves to just one specific geography. We wanted to go where we viewed the best talent. So all of our finance and all of our clinical is here in South San Francisco, California. And I think the US is still the gold standard in terms of finance as well as clinical trials. We have our chemistry is in Shanghai. The CRO infrastructure in Shanghai, if I need 20 chemists Friday, I can easily get 25 chemists and our team can sit across the table and we know the quality that we're getting and we can have that dialogue. If we don't need those 25 chemists 2 weeks later because we've tested our hypothesis, it's no biggie. We're able to easily turn on and off the spigot in terms of the chemistry talent because Shanghai has built this CRO infrastructure that's so robust. So, you know, we do a lot of the chemistry there. And then biology is in all locations because, again, I think we're still learning a lot of sort of biology. And so I think a lot of the talent's still in the US, but we're seeing a lot of talent in places like Shanghai. So we're distributed. 50% of our company is in Shanghai. 50% is here in South San Francisco.
And Ray, given your past experience working in Asia, what's something that you didn't understand or your approach has evolved in terms of working with Chinese colleagues versus colleagues here in the US?
I think the word that a lot of times that we use, culture becomes more complex. For example, the whole hybrid remote work environment in Shanghai, nobody wants to stay at home. People want to go to work. Their homes are small. They tend to have their parents and their grandparents are living there with the kids. And the office is seen as a place where you go and you work. They separate work and home in a very divided way. Whereas here in the US, we're starting to, many people like the idea of not having to get in the car, not having to deal with traffic. They can be more efficient with their time by working from home remotely. And so I think culturally, it's much more complex. I think for us at Structure Therapeutics, what we're learning is we've now come the start of the year. We're asking everybody to come back into the office. Because as a discovery and development company, we need those interactions, those conversations next to the coffee pot or in the parking lot or brainstorming or just BSing sometime That's where you get the real creative boost. Is it less efficient? Yes. But we're in a business that's all about creativity and drive and passion and mentoring as well. And so being in person, so it's something where we're adjusting and adapting our cultures. And then, of course, there's also the language, which is a challenge. There's a time zone that's a challenge. But what we found is, again, going to where there's sort of best talent, there's no place right now, any place else that we can find in the world where we can move chemistry as fast as we can. Again, there's no place in the world in terms of finance and clinical trials than the US right now. But it's a big world. And although parts of the world are getting more nationalized, we still believe that we're trying to develop a drug that's globally accessible to all. That's our mission statement that we have above the kitchen sink. We're trying to hit global population to really address a disease that's a big problem globally.
And Ray, given those ambitions and the fact that drug development tends to be a long slog with lots of failure along the way, how have you found that you can sustain both creativity and urgency over long periods of team as the leader of Structure Therapeutics?
I like to think, so deep down, I'm a chemist. Deep down, I think biology is messy. And so we love going after validated targets. So GLP-1, this as a drug class, you know, the first GLP-1 drug that made it to market was Byetta in 2005. It's been in millions of people. It's a very safe drug target. The biggest challenge we have is what's called an on-target tolerability, where your body naturally can get nauseous as you're getting on these drugs. But as a target, it's a very safe target. Our other targets, we go after validated targets. One of the reasons I think that investors liked us when we did the IPO, we don't take risks on the targets. We're not a first-in-class type of company. We're a best-in-class and go after biologics and make a small molecule. So by not taking risk, that helps a lot. The urgency, patients are waiting. Again, what drives us, this mission statement of accessibility, seeing what's happening globally as the obesity epidemic and diabetes epidemic just keeps growing exponentially. It's not slowing down, it's speeding up. We feel that urgency. And the people that come to the company, that join the company, they want to join this company because they see this, that same mission statement. One, we just had a new board member join, Ted Love, who is the CEO of Global Blood Therapeutics. Ted wanted to join us and he was getting approached by everybody. But what Ted really liked was our mission statement. What he was doing was sickle cell anemia and the drug that they developed. He really liked what we were doing about accessibility. He has that same vision, that same passion. So what's happened is we've attracted people that have the same shared passion and mission, and that really helps have all of us be aligned in working so hard to accomplish this mission.
You founded the company pre-pandemic. You went public in 2023. The funding environment and capital markets across life sciences have changed dramatically over the years. I'd love to hear your perspective on what's going on right now in 2024 and how you see the market changing over the next year or two.
I went through this cycle in 2013, 2012, 2013. It's almost identical. So being aware of that, there's a lot of capital out there. Fast forward 10 years, we raised almost $500 million last year. So our IPO was $185 million. And then in September, we raised $300 million extra. So there's a lot of capital out there. People want to put this capital to work. But what they're looking for is, first, they're looking for a strong team, strong investor base. They're looking for near-term catalyst. You need to have a readout within the next 9 to 12 months, I think is important. So for us, we had a readout at the end of last year in September and then in December. That helped. They're also looking for de-risking. So again, we don't go after validated. We don't go after first-in-class targets. We go after validated targets. So the risk goes down. Our biggest risk is small molecules. They can have more challenging safety challenges in front of them, but we spend extra time. We believe we have one of the safest oral GLP-1s out there right now. And that's because we spent so much extra time on that because we didn't have to take risk on biology. There's a lot of capital out there. I'm optimistic. Again, as a CEO, you have to be optimistic. JP Morgan last year, there was hail. It was ugly, miserable, yeah. Kind of dour. This year, there was such a positive attitude. I think we're coming out. We're seeing IPOs happening now. I think the numbers already passed all of last year. So I view a lot of positive enthusiasm. Like we were starting out with before in the conversation, there's going to be ups and downs for the field. There's going to be ups and downs for companies. And what's critical is you just keep looking ahead and focusing on what drives you. That's how you get through it.
Ray, before we let you run, you've shared quite a bit in terms of your learnings and evolution of how you think about drug development, leadership, et cetera. I'd love to ask you to reflect one last time. And what's one piece of advice you'd provide your younger self, knowing all that you now know?
I think the biggest piece of advice that I wish, when I was in college, I feel like I rushed through undergraduate. I rushed through graduate school. And I wished I had focused more on the fundamentals, the foundational aspects. This is a bad sort of lesson that I learned, but it was my first year of graduate school. And I was taking physical chemistry, thermodynamics. And there were students there that they just knew the fundamentals and they were able to get through it so easily. Whereas I just struggled. I was trying to memorize every little piece there, here and there. I wish I had spent more time on the fundamentals of science or the fundamentals of life in general, art, other aspects. That's where now going back, I'm learning those fundamentals more. So that's one piece of thing that as I was raising my own children, I tried to encourage them, learn the fundamentals because everything grows from there and spend that time on the really basic concepts and really understand them.
Great advice, Ray. Thank you for joining us today and for sharing your own personal journey, as well as the exciting work that you and your team are pursuing at Structure.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to listening to more of your podcast.
Thank you, Ray.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Biotech 2050. This episode is hosted by me, Rahul Chaturvedi, and Alok Tai. If you enjoyed this episode of Biotech 2050, please subscribe to our podcast and leave us a review. Also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Biotech2050Pod. Again, that's Biotech2050Pod. Until next time.